Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What is the history of the American notion of democracy, and do the values we strive for today correspond to what early political theorists like Thomas Paine imagined for us? Paine's 1776 pamphlet, Common Sense, sold 500,000 copies within a few months of publication and extolled the virtues of a government in which people at every stratum of society had a chance to participate. But as my guest today will discuss, the U.S. has struggled from its inception to put that ideal into practice. Lewis Lapham is former editor of Harper's Magazine and creator and editor of Lapham's Quarterly, where his essay Feast of Fools appeared in the fall issue. He's in town to address the Dallas Institute of Humanities and Culture tonight and the UTD Center for Brain Health tomorrow. Lewis, welcome to Think.
I'm glad to be here. Thank you, Chris.
I want to start with this. Lapham's Quarterly is called a magazine of history and ideas. Obviously, you looked around and saw that this was something that we lacked in the media culture today.
I think so. As you know, the history is not taught in a great many of our public schools today, and I think that's a loss, because I think that it's very hard to know where you've been, either as an individual or as a country. It's hard to know where you're going unless you know where you've been. So the historical record is our inheritance. The mankind salvages over the course of time what he finds to be useful, beautiful, or true. And some of those are political ideas. Some it's art, it's literature, it's scratchings in stone, and it's five-part plays and three-part songs. And so the idea of democracy as it develops in the United States, in the colonies, there was a lot of argument about it. What does it consist of? Direct democracy, the idea of everybody has a vote, was regarded by the people who wrote the Constitution as dangerous. They tended to think of the people as a rabble and a mob. I mean, the people that the gentlemen who wrote the Constitution were by and large well off, merchants from the northern colonies, from New England, from New York, or the planters from Virginia. They were educated, and Madison, in one of the Federalist Papers, says that the government ought to be set up and run by people who have the wisdom to discern and the virtue to pursue the common good.
And that was an idea that they took from Aristotle.
Yes, they take that idea from Aristotle. They take that idea from their reading of the classics. They were steeped in history. Jefferson, Madison, Hamilton, Franklin, all of them are great atoms, are all historians in the sense that they're familiar with the classic works. They're familiar with the writings of the philosophers in the 18th century Enlightenment, both in France, England, and Scotland. And democracy, the fundamental virtue of a democracy, maybe not virtue, but requirement, is reading and writing.
Mm-hmm.
And these people were good at it.
And I mean, these days, the idea that sort of a small subset of elite people should be in charge of democracy strikes us as rather abhorrent. In their defense, their sense was also that there was an obligation on the part of people who would be casting votes and making important decisions to be well-educated and steeped in that history and literate before being granted the privilege of voting?
Yes. I mean, as you remember, when the government was set up, the Senate, the upper house, was not directly elected by the people. It was chosen by the various state legislatures, would choose who among the leaders in their own state would serve as their representatives in the Senate in Washington.
And so tell us about Thomas Paine. He, in Common Sense, he sort of laid out his political philosophies. Before we talk about those, how had he arrived at his sense that people on every level of society ought to have an avenue by which to participate?
He had a great deal of experience among the common man. He's an Englishman and doesn't come to the United States until he's well into his 30s. And before that, growing up in England, he doesn't have much of an elite education. He doesn't go to Oxford or Cambridge. He comes from a very middle-class, working family. I think his father was a corset maker. I'm not sure. But he learns trades, and he tries different things. At one point in his early life, he's a privateer. And, at another point, he works as a tax collector. At another point, he's a magistrate in the town of Lewes in England. So he's an engineer, and today is in the Hall of Fame of American engineers because he invented the first iron bridge. He meets Benjamin Franklin in the 1770s in London. Franklin is a member of the Royal Society, or one of the scientific societies. It was a period when there was a great deal of correspondence between the educated people in France, England, the United States, the letters of Franklin, of Jefferson, and so forth. I mean, they're constantly in correspondence with each other, as are the committees of correspondence within the United States working out their own political destinies in New England towns and in the towns in Maryland and Virginia. They have their own constitutions. They think politics was a passion, and the whole late 18th century is consumed with the excitement of politics and the change and the possibility of revolution against an ancien regime and doing away with kings and monarchies and inherited wealth and inherited privilege. Franklin was impressed with Paine in their conversations in England and encouraged him to come to the United States. And he comes to the United States, if I remember correctly, in 1775. I think that's right.
Just in time to infuse...
Maybe late 1774. And just in time to get enthusiastic about what becomes the American idea.
Mm-hmm.
He writes for a newspaper. Franklin gets him a job writing for newspapers in Philadelphia. And he's actually one of the very first people in anywhere in the colonies to advocate the... equal suffrage for women, and also to write against slavery. He's got very, what we would consider, progressive ideas, and he has a great faith in the talent and the capacity of the common man. He thinks that a society profits, a democracy gains from all kinds of different people being present in the assembly. And he wants to hear from the mechanic and the shipbuilder as well as from the merchant and the lawyer. And he's the first person really to make the distinction between society and the state. Society, the impulse among people to help each other, is really what holds the society together, and government he sees as a necessary evil. There has to be some kind of regulation, and there has to be some notion of law and order. It cannot all be left to human nature, because human nature has its failings.
Anybody who's looked at history for 10 minutes has figured that out, yeah.
Yeah. But it's Franklin who persuades Paine in the fall of 1775 to write Common Sense. He really writes it on commission from Benjamin Franklin. And in this, it's a cri de coeur. It talks about the freedom of the individual. It talks about the monstrous tyranny of the English crown. It talks about the the ability of people to govern themselves and to work out their own destinies. And he puts it in the pamphlet is a marvelous piece of rhetoric, and he puts it in language that is easy to understand. The more educated elite members of the society, people like Hamilton and Adams and not so much Franklin, because Franklin is a wonderful writer, mm-hmm. with Poor Richard's Almanac and his letters, and he manages to speak more in the vernacular. But the
My guest is Lewis Lapham. He's with Lapham's Quarterly. Go ahead.
So he puts it into strong language, and it strikes a nerve. I mean, America is already at war. In 1775, there's been the Battle of Bunker Hill, mm-hmm. and the colonists are up in arms throughout the colonies. I mean, British governors have already been chased out of Philadelphia, out of New York, out of Charleston. They are living on British warships a mile offshore. The revolution is already in progress. But to give the notion of all men are created free and equal this rhetoric comes out of, or is flows from the Paine's rhetoric.
I have to tell you, when I read in your piece that 500,000 copies were distributed, I had to go and look up the population of the United States at the time, or the 13 colonies at the time, and it was something like 2.4 million. So
that's
basically
true.
A copy was in the household. It was in every household in the colonies.
Practically speaking, yes, yeah. It was. And there were also copies sold abroad. Paine was the best-selling author of the 18th century. There were, again, enormous sales of his subsequent books, The Age of Reason and The Rights of Man, which he publishes later after he's gone back from the United States to England and then to France. And I agree with you that it sounds like an extraordinary number, and I checked that source a couple of times, but unwilling to believe that was possible, but apparently it was. And many of the ideas that are in Common Sense, which comes out in January of 1776 and is widely read over the next several months. But the line of thinking is the one that Jefferson borrows to put into the Declaration of Independence when he comes to the writing of that in July, 6 months later.
Let me jump in. We have to take a quick break. My guest is Lewis Lapham, creator and editor of Lapham's Quarterly, former longtime editor of Harper's Magazine. We're speaking about his essay, Feast of Fools, which appeared in the fall issue of Lapham's Quarterly. He's in town to address the Dallas Institute of Humanities and Culture and the UTD Center for Brain Health. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. New spring semester personal enrichment and professional development courses are now open and available for registration. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Lewis Lapham, longtime editor of Harper's Magazine and creator and editor of Lapham's Quarterly. His essay, Feast of Fools, appeared in the fall issue. He's in town to address the Dallas Institute of Humanities and Culture tonight and the UTD Center for Brain Health tomorrow. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can email think@kera.org or you can call us at 1-800-933-5372. So, Lewis, as you were telling us, certainly Paine's ideas informed Jefferson's writing of the Declaration of Independence. And yet, just over a decade later, when the founders came together to draft a constitution, they seem to have set up a system that indicated they were less than confident in the ability of regular people to make important decisions?
Yes, they were not confident in that. And Adams is particularly virulent in his criticisms of Paine. He thinks that it's sheer folly to place power in the hands of the ignorant, the uneducated, the rabble, as he would have been inclined to say. And so that Paine, during the war, he not only writes Common Sense, but during the war, he writes the crisis papers. This is a time for, not for the sunshine patriot. I can't remember all of the rhetoric, but it was very heartening to the American war effort. We were usually suffering defeats at the hands of the British, and Paine is there in Valley Forge in the winter of 1777. But after the war, there's not really a place for him in American government. He's not a politician. He's more of an orator, more what we would think of as a radical, more of a Ralph Nader like figure, who wonderful with ideas, but not the kind of person you want to whom you want to leave the management of affairs. Mm-hmm. And so Paine goes to England and in 1787, and that's when he writes The Rights of Man. And a lot of the ideas in The Rights of Man are ones that don't appear again in the American system until the New Deal. I mean, he is for pensions, he's for equal rights for women, he's for the end of slavery. It's very progressive. Mm-hmm. But this, of course, puts him into trouble with the British monarchy. I mean, they think of him as truly a dangerous figure.
A revolutionary.
And the gentlemen in London had medals struck with Paine's head engraved on the medal, and then they'd attach these medals to the heels of their boots so that they could grind the face of Paine into the cobblestones. And eventually they hang him in effigy in many cities and towns in England, and he's forced to flee the country because the bailiffs are after him. They're going to put him in prison, and the man who helps get him across the channel, practically under the cover of darkness, is the poet and painter William Blake. But when Paine arrives in France, he is a hero because The Rights of Man is the Bible of the incipient French Revolution, and he's elected to the French Assembly to write the French Constitution. He doesn't speak French, but he's practically carried on the shoulders of a crowd, when he lands in Calais, and he appears in Paris, and he continues to propose his progressive ideas, which were in line with the early phase of the French Revolution. But then the French Revolution, it falls into the hands of Robespierre and the Reign of Terror. And Paine falls under suspicion because Paine gets up and makes a speech in the assembly. It's translated for him, but he argues against the killing of Louis XVI and Marie Antoinette. It's the first argument, again, that appears in the Western world against the death penalty.
On what grounds?
He says, you have overthrown the monarchy. To what purpose is the killing of the king?
At that point, it's just revenge.
What?
At that point, it would be just revenge or just sort of senseless violence.
Yeah, I mean, it achieves nothing. It's as murderous an approach as the one embraced by the monarchy. By the monarchy you have overthrown. The speech enrages Robespierre and the Jacobin wing of the revolution, and Paine is arrested, confined in the Luxembourg prison, and sentenced to death by the guillotine, which he escapes merely by chance, because they had several thousand people rounded up in the Luxembourg prison, scheduled for execution, and one never knew when's number was up, because a committee of the revolution would appear in the prison at midnight and go around and mark cell doors with a piece of chalk, and the next morning the thugs would come and collect the people in the cells so marked, and off they would be taken to the guillotine by noon. But it was in the summer, and it so happened that Paine's door had been opened on an adjacent cell, and so the chalk mark was put on the inside door of an adjacent cell, and that's just the reason that Paine escaped. And about a week later, Robespierre himself was guillotined. So it was a very narrow escape.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also join the conversation by emailing think@kera.org. Let's go on the phone now to Andrew in Dallas. Hello, Andrew.
Hello. I have a question for your guest. Were the founding fathers, Paine or others, aware of the Polish, Lithuanian, Ruthenian Commonwealth, now Eastern Europe, that stretched from the Baltics to the Black Sea, and their experience with democracy when they introduced democracy here? And I'll take the response off the air. Thank you.
I don't know the answer to that question. I'm sure that some of them did, because they read widely and followed affairs in Europe. But I have yet, in my reading around in the background of the Constitution, I have yet to see reference to that. To that democratic government in Eastern Europe.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Jerry is on the line now in Denton. Hello, Jerry.
Yes, hi. I'd just like to hear Mr. Eflin expand a little more about the British attitude towards Paine. And my understanding was that a lot of their antipathy towards him was based not so much about his American relations, but what they considered to be his traitorous relationship with the French Revolutionary government.
Actually, it was his traitorous relationship with the English government, because he goes to England and writes the Rights of Man, and this is stirring up a democratic feeling and incipient rebellion and enthusiasm among the less well-off people in Britain. I mean, there are crowds that are favor Paine, and they're not only in London but also in York and in Manchester and in Liverpool, and this is what frightens the British authorities. And Paine, if you remember Edmund Burke, Burke is in answer to Paine's Rights of Man, Burke, who was a friend of Paine, writes his pamphlet against the revolution in France, and it becomes the British detested the French Revolution. I mean, so it was first Paine's stirring up a popular democratic sentiment in England, and then his alliance with the French Revolution.
So with regard to this country, Lewis, if you create a democracy that is still somewhat paternalistic and leans heavily on the powers granted to the aristocracy, that all works fine if you can trust the aristocratic class to do the right thing for the people in charge. And this was the big fear, right, that ultimately the more wealth accumulated, the more tendency toward corruption, that sort of thing.
Yes, this is, again, the point made by Aristotle, which is that all government, whatever you want to call it, republic, monarchy, tyranny, democracy, starts with a small number of people. And this is the point made by Aristotle, as wealth accumulates, the men decay. Mm-hmm. After a while, the leading citizens or the oligarchy, however you wish to define it, becomes utterly selfish and lazy and it no longer working for the common good. Montesquieu says the same thing, who's another one of the Enlightenment writers from whom the foundation, the founders borrow from the spirit of the laws, in which he defines the central characteristic, the necessary characteristic of democracy as virtue. As long as you have the people in control of the government trying to do the best thing, and who presumably are themselves sufficiently wealthy, so they will not be too quickly tempted to steal. this generation, these ideas have to be regenerated with every generation. I mean, it's freedom is not a trust fund. I mean, it's something that you can't buy the future. I mean, it's something you have to earn, and you have to work at it. I mean, democracy is in the Republican sense, which is the sense that the founders had, is the hardest form of government.
I was interested, we're going to fast forward here to the Gilded Age, and you talk about Grover Cleveland vetoing aid to the poor and saying, and here's a quote, "The lesson should be constantly enforced that though the people support the government should not support the people." Of course, today many people seem to espouse that the people should not support the government either, and we've gotten to a place where no one's quite sure in whom to trust.
Yes, I mean, you have Mark Twain saying in the Gilded Age that a society that values or that is consists only of vanity and greed is not a society at all. It is a state of war. And you look at the election of 1876 with Tilden and Hayes. I mean, one of the truly most corrupt elections in the history of the country. Both candidates were buying constituencies. Bribes were changing hands at, Wall Street rates. I think there were, if eventually the election went into the House of Representatives, and there must have been 20 or 30 ballots before they finally decided for Rutherford B. Hayes. But yes, I mean, when you again, in Aristotle's notion, when oligarchy degenerates to the point where the only quality is money, you begin to run into trouble.
Does it give you hope for our future, given the situation that we're in right now, that after the Gilded Age, we moved towards some reforms? There were, not just social reforms, but moving into, as you mentioned, the Depression and the New Deal, that there was a sense of greater populist power?
Well, yes. I mean, the change was brought about by the catastrophe of the Depression. People had to. How do you keep the? How do you keep the economy alive without some sort of equal distribution of the wealth and borrowed the ideas of John Maynard Keynes to stimulate the whole of the economy and we the things that we think of today as welfare state, the Social Security, some of the labor laws, labor unions come out of the New Deal subsequent to the, as possible answers to the problem presented by the Depression.
My guest is Lewis Lapham, longtime editor of Harper's Magazine and creator and editor of Lapham's Quarterly. He's in town to address the Dallas Institute of Humanities and Culture tonight and the UTD Center for Brain Health tomorrow. We'll come back to the conversation in about 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. New spring semester personal enrichment and professional development courses are now open and available for registration. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with the creator and editor of Lapham's Quarterly, Lewis Lapham, who was also longtime editor of Harper's Magazine. We're talking about his essay, Feast of Fools, which appeared in the fall issue. He's in town to address the Dallas Institute of Humanities and Culture tonight and the UTD Center for Brain Health tomorrow. If you'd like to join us, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. In light of what we've been discussing this hour, Lewis, can you talk a little bit about how our notion of liberty and what it means has changed over time in this country?
Well, I mean, we've developed this notion of rights. In other words, not freedom to do or freedom to make, but freedom to as an entitlement. And freedom is not something that can be given to you. And power is not something that can be given to you either. I mean, one of the lessons you learn from history is that freedom must be earned, and it's freedom of the mind that is the best of all possible freedoms, which is that's also the point of ancient philosophy as well as 18th century politics. And we've confused the worth of a thing with the price of a thing. We think the price of the thing is what gives it value, but that's a mistake. And the so we tend to think of freedom as license, and it liberty is not license. It's the freedom to make and to build, and not to have and to hold.
Many people feel like the most important freedom, I'm speaking for some people, feel like the most important freedom is freedom from any kind of government oversight, regulation, that sort of thing.
Well, I mean, you need some sort of a government. I mean, certainly the founders had that in mind. Hamilton sets up the bank without which the new republic doesn't survive.
Not a popular decision at the time.
No. I think the first building in Washington, the first government building in Washington is the Patent Office, which is to grant copyright. I mean, the idea of the Constitution, it's an instrument. It's like a plow or an axe. It's something. It's the freedoms that allow you to find fortune and happiness. It isn't give you fortune and happiness, but it allows you to seek it. But everybody understands, as even did Paine, that there has to be some form of government, and we have all kinds of government help written into our not only into our Constitution but also into our institutions. I mean, we have more or less open markets. We have the SEC. We have food and drug. We have all kinds of Coast Guard maps. I mean, the government performs many services that are necessary to the evolving of the citizenry.
Do you think that part of the resistance that many people feel to paying more into the government has to do with the fact that we equate power with money, and any money that the government takes from us is essentially, I mean, if you boil it down, is taking power from us and giving that power to the government?
Yes, but the government is providing services for that, for our tax money. Our taxes at the moment are relatively low. I mean, I can remember when the tax rate during the Eisenhower administration was close to 70% or 80%. It's government performs a social good, and it should provide the infrastructure on which the society can build its future. The rule of law.
What does it say about our culture that so many Americans profess and sincerely do, I believe, love their country and hate their government at the same time?
Well, I think that's I'm not sure what they mean. A lot of the people, when they say they love the country, I'm not sure what they mean by the country. Do they mean the flag? Do they mean the armies and its fleets? The love of country, the love is the country's freedoms. The idea of I respect my fellow man as a citizen, not because he or she is rich or famous, but because he or she is a fellow citizen. And another one of the chief virtues is candor, that we tell each other the truth, that we're on a journey. I mean, the American journey is usually the one of self-invention. But if you're at one point, we meet, you and I, and we try to tell each other where we've been and what we know and what we think might be over the next hill or around the next turn in the river. And at that point, we really have to tell each other the truth if it's going to work. And if too many people are burbling lies, whether they're in Congress or in Wall Street, it falls apart.
Talk a little bit about the media, because you write really interestingly here about it appears to many people that we openly and honestly argue about, debate about the things that we hold dear, often within the media. Your sense is that money has really gotten in the way of that, and it's much more of an empty exercise than it might appear to many people.
I think it is. I mean, you look at the presidential election last year, and I can't remember, you probably know, how many billion dollars was invested in the campaigns. And we tend to judge our candidates in terms of how much money they can raise. I mean, they can't even get into the race unless they can develop enough money in the early primaries to become viable candidates. In other words, they are expensive farm equipment that cultivates votes. And so, and the idea is to say as little as possible that might offend an opinion poll or might offend the source of your funding, so that the candor that I was talking about earlier, there tends to be very little of it in an election campaign. It's spectacle. It's money talking to money.
You remind us that members of Congress spend about 50% of their time fundraising, and so therefore it's their staffs that are actually learning what this legislation that they're supposed to vote on actually means, and writing the speeches that they make to respond to it.
Well, and that, of course, is very different from the founding generation. Mm-hmm. Founding generation, they write their own letters. They write their own, you know, they have their own ideas. I mean, the Federalist Papers is written by Madison, and Hamilton and John Jay are extraordinarily thoughtful and articulate. I mean, and these are not written for polls. And it's also very hard to, given the speed of our media, to answer a difficult question in a phrase or in a soundbite. And so it's a very good question. I mean, the Republican democracy that we set up is based on literacy. I mean, again, there was unfairness. Women didn't have the vote, and neither did slaves. Neither did people without a certain minimum of property. But again, democracy, as I said, is a truly hard form of government, and it does take a fairly advanced degree of literacy to be able to make it work.
To the extent that a lot of Americans, if they possess that degree of literacy, they choose not to use it, or they choose not to seek out sources of information that are credible. What do we do about this problem?
Well,
in the 3 minutes that I've given you before the show ends.
At that point, I get to make my speech on behalf of Lapham's Quarterly. Lapham's Quarterly takes an idea in the news, war, money, politics, and then brings to bear on it the voices of the past, so that we publish Madison, we publish Jefferson, we publish Voltaire, Thucydides, and so on, focused on a topic in the day of the moment. So my answer is education, and because what do we do about it is we improve our means of education, and that means with not only with federal money and state money, but also with what is the purpose of an education? What are we trying to? It's not data.
Mm-hmm.
It's to awaken people to the power of their own minds.
It's interesting that you bring that up, because it's also the idea that an education is for more than just allowing you to earn a living later
yes,
on.
Yes, right. If it's just there's that kind of an education too. There are trade schools, okay, but to turn a liberal arts education, the examined life education in philosophy, how to live and how to die, to turn that into just a precede to business school is a mistake.
Do you think we will reverse course and head back in the right direction?
Well, we've done it before. I mean, nobody dies in the country in which he or she is born. I mean, the America that George Washington's America is not Abraham Lincoln's America,
yeah.
Is not Dwight Eisenhower's America, is not Barack Obama's America. And what we have shown over the 200 years of our existence is the ability to change and to rejuvenate or to reinvent. I mean, you have to, again, government and is a living thing. It's not a monument. And yes, I mean, it's entirely conceivable. You look over time, you look over history, you take the very long view, and you have a constant rising and falling.
Lewis Lapham is former editor of Harper's Magazine and creator and editor of Lapham's Quarterly, where his essay Feast of Fools appeared in the fall issue. He's in town to address the Dallas Institute of Humanities and Culture tonight and the UTD Center for Brain Health tomorrow. Lewis, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Chris.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bilotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is our senior producer. You can learn more about the show, find out about upcoming programs, and download the podcast free at kera.org/think. And we always welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions emailed to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.